Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA.
My gosh.
They're all going against the wind.
It was basically a cube with inside of sphere where the points of the cube were touching outside of the sphere.
So this isn't anything that just is limited to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
Hey, this is Bryant Arnold, also known as Dragon from Skinwalker Ranch, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and really looking forward to speaking to the guest I've got on the show this week. Very quickly, before I get to that, I just want to give you a heads up that next week's show, that should be released on or around the 27th of November, is going to be the long-awaited roundtable number 2, and that is with Dan, Dave Partridge from Shadows Magazine, and the Undead Gout Show, and we are going to be discussing your theories on the phenomenon, what it is, where it comes from, any agendas, and we'll go down the rabbit hole a little bit on that one as well. You've sent in loads of stuff already. I've got enough to do 2 or 3 shows on, so thank you very, very much. But yeah, look out for that one coming next week. On the show with me this week, I'd love to welcome Steve McDaniel, who is the founder and lead software engineer from Skyhub. Steve, how are we doing today?
We're doing great. I really appreciate you having me on your show today.
No, awesome. Looking forward to speaking with you, obviously. We've been talking for a few minutes before we hit the record button, which has been good. Someone that I've followed for a while, at NibbleShift on Twitter, on the UFO Twitter feed. Actually, I'm going to ask you this one that I never mentioned. What is NibbleShift as a handle?
So it's interesting because it's kind of like a computer science thing. A nibble is half an octet, and a shift is a mathematical operation that you often use in programming. So I just took the nibble and shift and threw them together, and I've been using that for my online handle for years.
So it's safe to say you're quite geeky, like
maybe a little bit.
I'm in that field as well. I mean, I've got a UFO podcast, so of course I'm going to put myself in the geek category. So I can't really not. but listen, Skyhub seems to be growing leaps and bounds and is getting really, really prominent. I want to give a very quick shout out at the start of this, and I'll bring it in again later on, that Jeremy McGowan, one of my previous guests on the podcast, he's got a GoFundMe just now, which is, you know, doing quite well, and he's looking to actually build one of these modules that we're going to be speaking about. So if you get a chance, once you've listened to the show, check out Jeremy's GoFundMe, and I'll put the links in the description as well. First thing, Steve, is a little bit about you and the journey that's led you to Skyhub. So I'm assuming, given the nature of the project that you're involved in and what you do, you've got an interest in UAP and UFOs. Is that right?
I do. I definitely have an interest. And I can kind of give a little background on that. I've always been somewhat interested in the topic. I've never taken it really seriously. I'd catch an occasional documentary every so often. And that was essentially the extent of my interest, right? I always enjoyed sci-fi movies. But things really changed when TTSA went public. So when Christopher Mellon and Lou Elizondo got up on stage and said the UFO phenomenon is real, I was kind of looking at that like, wow, we have these two intelligence guys. They're credible. They have great reputations, and they're standing here saying we should take this seriously. And that's really when I got more interested in the topic. And that's when I eventually made my way to UFO Twitter, where we all end up apparently. And that's what kind of kicked off the journey into working on SkyHub.
So it's almost been a bit of a later entry for you in like a kind of serious fashion. And what I always find quite interesting is, and it's something I just put online yesterday on my Twitter feed, was did TTSA coming out in December 2017 change the direction of the conversation and the topic? And on the poll, it was unanimously almost that yes, it did. And there's still a lot of people who are very old-fashioned, you know, retro UFOs, and that's fine. There's a huge history to the topic. But it's got people like yourself and to an extent as well myself in the game that you want to be involved and really take this forward, which can't be any bad thing. And people have been screaming out for years that they wanted the government to acknowledge UFOs, UAPs, whatever you want to call them. Here are the government. You know, Chris Mellon was very much the government. Lou Elizondo, very much a patriot and, you know, heavily involved, and they came out and acknowledged that. Did you have any interest going further back to like childhood, or was it very much something that's kind of crept up, as you say, in later life?
I've always been interested since I was a kid, but the introduction with Chris Mellon and Lou Elizondo was the thing that was like, okay, let's really, like, what can I do to kind of help? Like, how can I figure this problem out, right?
So you see those guys on stage and they come out and basically, I mean, let's not put it in any other terms than UFOs are real. That's what they came out and said. Here's some videos, which are, you know, pretty incredible, prompted a lot of conversation as well. What are the conversations then for you that lead to the inception of SkyHub?
So it's interesting. So I want to give like kind of my take on the videos, right?
You know, oh, please. Yeah.
This is really, I'll keep it really simple. So I'm very skeptical about the videos. So my position is there's not enough evidence to actually make a conclusion based on those videos. But I think those videos are good enough evidence that we can take action on. I think it deserves further scientific inquiry.
And when you say no conclusion, what you mean is no one's saying, or you're not saying, these are alien spacecraft, which people kind of jump to.
So I don't think we can make any kind of conclusion on what they are at all. And I think they're very interesting. I think they're compelling, and I think they should be looked into. And I've convinced myself that that's the right approach, is that we should be extremely skeptical about the videos, but we should also take them very serious.
And I think that's a really fair approach as well. And we've got our famous skeptics online just now who are quite quick to jump in and say what they aren't. And even for like myself, I'm not claiming these are alien spacecraft, or they're clearly pretty incredible craft or objects, whichever they are. I personally don't think they're helium balloons flying along the seabed at incredible speed, or a flock of seagulls that have been caught. But again, that's because people with far greater technical expertise than me, or people with government clearances, have came out and said, and like you've just said, these are worth further, and you've used the phrase in scientific study, which is absolutely fair. What do you think then? Because you've brought it up now, and I'll talk about it. What do you think about the quality of the videos?
I think they're good quality, right? So they're better than most of the videos that we see. And it's not just that they're better. It's the chain of evidence that matters. So we know the provenance of those videos, and they came from the DOD, and I think that's important. They didn't just come from some random guy on his cell phone in a shaky, blurry video. Like, they were literally recorded on the most sophisticated systems that were available at the time. So I think they are good videos. I just think more data needs to be available to the public.
So that's where someone like yourself, with a clear level of technological expertise far beyond the average person, thinks, I can get involved in this. So what are then the next steps for you into the creation of SkyHub?
So this dates back earlier this year. So I was actually part of an organization called UAPTN, and I was working with Joel Dodd and Bob McGuire. And we worked on a system that would essentially use off-the-shelf cameras and sensors to collect data. As we worked through this over time, UAPTN evolved into SkyHub, and we turned it into an open source project and wanted to build a community out of it. We wanted it to be open. Anybody can join. Anybody can grab the code and add features. So the kind of the concept was, we wanted to have a sensor for any type of environmental reading. We wanted to be able to support several different kinds of cameras and optics. So the best way to do that is put the code out there for free and just let experts come in from different fields and add those capabilities. So as we worked through this, the whole goal was, you know, SkyHub's not for me, it's for everybody. Our goal, like the platform is just a means to an end. The real goal is actually accumulating and creating this data set for the public. So if we can support this community with this infrastructure with trackers all over the globe, we can collect sensor data, atmospheric data, magnetic ratings, RF, deploy passive radars, collect all this data in a public cloud, and allow the community and experts and researchers to go analyze this data. And I think my number one goal with it was, we need compelling evidence to get mainstream scientists engaged in the topic. And the best way to get them engaged is to give them data.
And that's awesome. From the outset, it's been, let's give this to everyone for free. There's no paywall behind it. There's no, if you sign up to this, then you get X, Y, and Z. And if you pay a little bit more, you get this. It's very much people can go, and there is a cost involved, but that's not going into your pocket and making you a millionaire off the back of it. You're not charging people $2,000 and $3,000 for something they'll get nothing out of. It's very much a project for people. What is the audience, though, this is aimed at, would you say? And has that changed from the start of SkyHub to now?
So we've been very narrow in our focus. Our focus is observational science. That is our goal. We're creating a platform to collect data, to aggregate it into the cloud. So we want to maintain that core goal. And fortunately, our core goal overlaps with lots of other scientific fields. So if we're collecting observational science data and watching the sky 24/7 and collecting atmospheric data, that also applies to atmospheric scientists and meteorologists and even people that are interested in bird migration patterns. So that data set's available for other scientists to get involved in. We will always focus on the core UFO research, but we will also enable other scientists to use this data for any type of scientific research. And we're more than happy to provide a mechanism for universities and scientists to leverage that data.
So it really is open and it's for everyone. And that's quite interesting. I hadn't thought of that or considered that this could be used for meteorological purposes. That's hard to say in a Scottish accent. But like you say, bird migration patterns, or if you're into weather phenomena, this can be used for a whole host of things. But I suppose most people listening to this, and the idea behind it is where people are looking for UFOs or unidentified aerial phenomenon, that sort of thing as well, which is the main goal behind it. I take it that this might be a really obvious question, but you've built one of these yourself?
Yes. So I actually have like four of these. So, and the equipment has graciously been donated by some folks, and I bought some myself, but I essentially have each configuration for the platform set up in my lab so I can test each device to make sure that when we make updates and deployments, that no matter which piece of hardware users chose, it's been tested and it should work. So I have one production tracker and I have three test trackers that I run just to make sure everything always works for everyone.
I think there's a lot of very jealous people out there just now. It's the equivalent of the people trying to get a PlayStation 5 just now, but they hear that someone's bought two and there's people that would love one SkyHub and you've got four. So yeah,
that's got to keep things rolling. Got to keep it testing.
Oh, absolutely. That's really cool. So why the name SkyHub? What's behind the name? And were there any names you thought about or considered that you didn't quite make it in the end?
So no, we actually, that was kind of like,
the name,
you know, we were looking at like better branding. What's catchy? What's cool? What's hip? And I mean, a lot of the branding and design we owe to Adam, who's also on the SkyHub team. Like he did all the branding for SkyHub, and we came up with the name. It just stuck, right? Like it was a great name. The domain was available, and it's kind of a cool, hip, nice looking platform that looks professional, right? So it's something that you can really push, and it has actually worked very well in the community.
It's very modern, and even the, as you say, the graphics, the logos all looks the part, which with these sorts of things can be half the battle, that it looks professional, it draws people in. It made me, before I knew what it was, and all you see is a name, and I suppose that's the same for my podcast, that yeah, the podcast gives the title, but you want people to click on a logo, you want them to look at a description, you then want them to kind of buy into it, and you want them to invest their time and their efforts and focus on this to contribute to that data field that you're looking at, which is amazing. So you touched on Adam there. So I'd like to know, who is the team behind SkyHub?
So originally, Corey Gaspard and I have done all the development for the platform. And Adam is our data licensing and resident lawyer. So he handles all the data licensing. He handles all the legal stuff for the organization. He's also an enthusiast, and he's been a huge supporter. When we started this, Adam was one of the first guys in. He was out there deploying cameras on top of buildings and setting up the first test trackers that we actually deployed. He actually put those up out in Houston. And as we started to mature, Richard Hoff came along. He is actually the one that's responsible for that beautiful SkyHub tracker enclosure. So he actually modeled and designed that entire enclosure and has done all the models for all of that. And one little nice thing about that, we're actually working on mass producing those enclosures. So we're currently in talks with manufacturers, because we had a gracious donation to actually cover the costs of the tooling and manufacturing. So soon we will have pre-orders available for that case. So thanks to Richard for that.
I've actually two things on that. One of the listener questions is from Richard, and second one of the listeners' questions is when will enclosures be available? So that's you've got one there. So that's good to know that they're almost going to be in production. Mm-hmm. Can you give a date or a time scale on that for people?
So we're hoping to have the enclosures available by January. So that's currently the timeline. It seems like the world is a little bit slowed down with COVID going on. So we're working through the process and working with the manufacturers to hopefully get those to people in the next couple months.
No, so save your Christmas money if you're looking for a SkyHub enclosure.
Yeah, let us know and we'll get you one pre-ordered. But outside of Richard, Chris Cogswell, and a lot of people know Chris, we actually asked Chris to come be the chair of our scientific advisory board, because I'm not a PhD, and there were no other PhDs on the team, and we wanted somebody with scientific credibility and a PhD that could navigate the scientific community and help drive the science of SkyHub. And he's done a fantastic job of setting up a scientific advisory board, and they really helped drive kind of the requirements and details of some of the things that we're implementing. And we also have David Moore, who is a PhD and did digital signal processing. So he does audio engineering, and he handles scientific communications for SkyHub. And he's been a massive contributor to SkyHub and is largely responsible for the great documentation that's available for putting the SkyHub together. And that, awesome. That pretty much covers the core team.
So again, that's a team there that are working. And is it safe to say that's largely they're volunteering their time, given the nature of the project and what's involved? Is it something you've got funding behind to pay salaries? And
no, this is all a side hustle. We do all of this for free. So everybody has contributed their expertise and time for free. People have made all of their own financial investments for the equipment. So we are literally spending money out of our own pockets to put this whole thing together.
And that says a lot about the goals behind and, you know, the morals behind the project as well. And I think that's why more and more people are getting involved. While it's still a relatively new company and project compared to some, have you spoken to any third parties? So obviously you've told me there that To the Stars Academy and their big announcement was a bit of an inspiration into kickstarting the whole thing. Have you spoken or reached out to them or any others about getting involved, or what they can do or what you can do for them?
So we've talked to a lot of people around the community, and I think there's an intense interest for lots of groups around the community to collaborate towards a goal, right? Because we're all looking for data and we're all looking for answers. And we aren't partnered with anyone other than the SCU right now. And that's a great organization to be a part of. If your listeners aren't aware of SCU yet, go check them out. Go become members and support that organization as well. But really, what it comes down to is we're all working towards the same thing. So if there's other organizations out there, such as SCU and TTSA, hey, let's work together and let's make this happen.
And while you've touched on it, I don't mind if you want to talk a little bit about SCU, you know, what it is, how people can get involved, and what it means for you.
So initially when we got into this, SCU was one of the first organizations that we joined. So SCU is the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. So it's a group of engineers and scientists and professionals that are interested in the topic and want to pursue this scientifically. So they've put out some great papers, and it's a great organization to get access to researchers and scientists that that are also interested in the topic. And you can go to their website and sign up as a member if you have an interest in helping with different aspects of the project, or you're a scientist or an engineer. There's always a place to get involved in either SkyHub or SCU or both of them. A lot of the members at SkyHub have also joined as SCU members. So I highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah, people should definitely do that. And listen, something that has been screaming out for a long, long time in this subject and in this field is more scientists to get involved, and mainstream scientists. And I mean, ideally, you want really, really skeptical people coming on, and people, yes, that don't have that belief that I believe in aliens, I believe these are coming from different planets, different dimensions, they're on this planet. You want people to come in and almost try and disprove it, because again, people know my thoughts. I don't think they'll be able to. So you want really hardline scientists to come in, look at the best possible data, which SkyHub is going to be a huge part of that, and give us their thoughts. You know, what is this? What could it be? What can you eliminate from it? And that's how we're going to move this subject forward rapidly. We're in a bit of a, I mean, by the time this comes out, there may have been some UAP news leaking. If, you know, you're involved in UFO Twitter, if you've seen the last week and a half, there's a lot of rumors that we're going to see some news drops this week, potentially as early as tomorrow. And then the 2nd of December for another drop keeps being mooted as well. I won't go into the rumors at what might be coming out. I've heard a few different things. These have traditionally in the past led to being a little bit anticlimactic. So I think people can get their hopes up that they're going to wheel an alien body out of somewhere and show it on TV. But, you know, if we get some documentation or extended videos or a photograph, you know, who knows what might come out. But again, if it's some sort of, you know, scientific announcement, or, you know, some data that backs up something we've had before, then that would be great. Have you heard anything yourself, Steve, about anything that's coming out?
I've been hearing the rumors and hearing the hype building up. The best I can say is, you know, let's just wait patiently. Let's not speculate, and, you know, just wait for the goods to come out.
And that's it. And hopefully it is goods and not just okay. But yeah, anything that moves things forward for me is always a good thing, which we'll look forward to. What I want to ask you then, so right now, the idea for people, if you've been listening, you've heard that SkyHub is basically, you could go online, you've got all this as open source code. I'm not obviously that technical, but yeah, yes. Is that the right language?
Correct.
Is all there, that you've got the blueprints basically to build these machines that are basically going to track a part of the sky where you live. And what I've loved tracking SkyHub, online on Twitter, is seeing people from all around the world who have their own builds of these machines. I think one of them had very strategically placed it on the edge of the roof and had to build like a almost like a seal or clamp to keep it down, which was really interesting. And
yeah.
So seeing stuff like that's really, really cool, because these are just your kind of average Joes who want to have an interest in this subject. So I've got here that there's a cost involved. That's obviously, it's done for free by people like yourself, but if I want to get involved, I need to pay. So what are we looking at setup wise and cost wise for the equipment?
So it really depends on the route you go. So we've tried to make this accessible for people, but we also want high fidelity videos, right? So there's a balance there. So It's not going to be super cheap. You know, you're not going to be able to go get set up for $100, but it's, you know, there's a small price to pay for getting high fidelity data. So we tried to break it down into tiers for people. So we essentially have a good, better, best option. So starting at the base, you probably get away for about $600 or $700 for a platform. You can go as high as about $3,000. And if you really want to spend a lot of money on optics, and optics can get very expensive, the sky is essentially the limit. So just to give an example, I have a setup and it was probably around $3,000 just for one tracker. And that includes high-end fisheye, high-end PTZ, all the sensors, and the high-end board. Now, if you don't want to go spend $3,000, which I don't recommend you do, you know, you could put together a very nice setup for $600 to $700 and be rolling and have lots of sensors, great optics, and you know, a very nice enclosure.
And again, this is a time when people maybe don't have as much disposable income or cash as they have had in the past, or, you know, hope in the near future people's circumstances get a lot better. However, at the end of the day, like I mentioned before, PlayStation 5 just came out, and that sets you back in the US $500.
Oh yeah.
Scalpers are selling them for 4 or 5 times that. But obviously, let's go with $500 base price, a couple of games, and an extra control pad. They are $700 or $800 easily anyway. So it's still a relatively, you know, sensible amount of money that you can put out on what's some really good equipment.
Right.
What are you going to get? So you've said you've got a good, better, best option. What levels of recording and data can you expect to get from those three options? What's the difference you're going to see?
So right now we're recording between 8 and 12 megapixel video streams from anywhere from 25 to 30 frames per second. So this is just with our fisheye camera. As we progress and get further down the road, we'll deploy the support for pan, tilt, and zoom cameras. This is where it'll get really interesting, because we'll have high-end optics that can actually track objects in the sky and zoom in on them. And that's where we'll get really good close-up imagery of objects. And those cameras generally produce images in 4K. So you can go up to 8K, but 4K is really where it's like cost-effective and high-quality.
So trying to help the layman's out here, and I would put myself above a layman, but well below some of the equipment you've mentioned. A fisheye is just your standard, and I suppose it's what you can see on some of the videos if you go on the website and whatnot and look. It's just your one camera looking up at the sky, and you can see a bit of a, is concave the right word? Like it kind of bends across?
Yes. So it actually, it's great for sky watching. So what it does is a fisheye camera, the ones that we use give you around 180 degree field of view. So you can essentially see the entire sky above you if you have no obstructions around the camera. So you can have a very, very good view of the sky. And where that's useful is that we can actually detect motion in almost any part of the sky. And when we enable support for the pan, tilt, and zoom camera, we can detect with a fisheye, and the pan, tilt, and zoom will actually zoom in on the object that's detected on the fisheye and then track it with the pan, tilt, and zoom camera. So that's kind of how we intend to pair them together.
What's going to be the difference? So I've got that. So say I go for the basic setup and I've got that fisheye camera. I've got the lower end of the range, but it's still, like you say, going to be some good equipment I've got there to pick up some data. And then I come into some money and I want to upgrade and go for the higher end equipment. What difference are you going to get on your end when you receive that data from me? What's going to be the clear differences?
So it really depends on the optics. So on our end, it really won't matter. We'll just get like slightly higher quality data. Your unit might be able to run more intense machine learning models, which that's one of the big things, right? So we're doing machine learning at the edge. So the tracker actually runs NVIDIA DeepStream, and we're applying different algorithms to the video stream to help classify or detect anomalies and track optical flow vectors and motion vectors. So the better equipment you get, the more intense algorithms you can run at the edge, which is useful for us in the cloud because you do all that computing on your tracker that can just be sent up to the cloud. As far as the video quality, it really depends on the optics. So I do recommend getting a camera that's between 8 and 12 megapixels for the fisheye. So if you go to our wiki, we actually have a list of hardware that we recommend for the baseline. And that same camera for the fisheye is really recommended across the good, better, best options. The difference between the good, better, best is going to be how many cameras you can actually deploy. So I think it's feasible that eventually we'll have a configuration with three cameras on the tracker, which would include a fisheye, and then it include a MIPI camera and a pan, tilt, and zoom camera. I know this is somewhat technical, but like kind of our intention is we want that flexibility for people. And the great thing about this project is you don't have to do it exactly as we say. If you find ways to improve or put other sensors on the platform is there for you to build on. We just want to provide that framework and infrastructure to people to innovate.
It's like buying a PC. Like I've just upgraded my setup recently in here from a laptop to a desktop, which allows me to do a lot more. But I bought a basic PC and I've added some different components to it and upgraded it. So it runs faster. I can do more things with it. You can run better games. You can run better software. And that's the same idea behind SkyHub, that as you say, you said the sky's the limit, but it is, because you can customize and change this to be what you want it to be. What's this ideal setup for you then? So I live in a pretty built up area. It's quite busy. Let's just say it's not the most affluent area. It can be a little bit rough where I stay, and I set up a SkyHub. I've got the enclosure, everything else on top of, say, a garage I have. Is that the safest place to have that in this area? Is there like an ideal location?
So I personally, like, I don't have to worry about that. I kind of live out in the country, but if you're going to put it in a location, you want to make sure it's properly secured. I mean, obviously you don't want somebody to like walk up and, you know, pick up your SkyHub and walk away with it. So I do recommend putting it in a location people can't access. And if it is, you will want to properly secure it. You can put a door lock on the SkyHub tracker. So on the panel, it'll have hinges and you can actually throw a lock on there and make it so no one can open it. And if you secure it to the ground, no one will be able to take it.
What sort of size are we talking? Again, the sizes, I take it, go up depending on the good, better, best.
So actually the enclosure is the same size for all three platforms. So we use the same box. I don't know if the measurements have changed in the latest revisions, but it was roughly, 10 by 10 by 20, I believe is roughly where we were at. So it's not huge. It's a very good size case, and we basically tried to make it as small as possible, but still maintaining flexibility and extendability.
And what units of measurement are you using for the 10 by 10 by 20? Sorry.
I'm sorry. Inches.
Inches. Okay, yes. Cool. Cause I was thinking, is that feet? Because just depending where you're listening, feet and inches in the UK might be a little bit, or centimeters. So yeah, that's pretty reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah.
10 inches by 10. Yeah. So that would be doable. Cause I've got, where I live, the skies are also very clear. I'm outside of the city enough that the light pollution's not as bad. And I've got a trampoline I don't have a trampoline. The kids have a trampoline. I'm too fat for a trampoline. In the summer particularly, I like to lie in the trampoline and you can look up at the stars and you see the Starlink satellites going over. And so it's really, really nice. So I would quite like a SkyHub for where I live, but it would have to be very much tacked to the ground. But like you say, with one of these enclosures, and you could secure it, which is the main thing for people. But if you live in a nicer area, that's probably not something you have to worry about.
But I mean, And we talked a little bit about an ideal deployment. So I want to talk a little bit about how to configure it, or how, like the parts to put inside of it. So ideally, you want the sensor platform and you want good optics. So I would definitely deploy with an Xavier NX, and that's the better option. So that's the middle of the road option for the tracker. And then I would deploy with a good fisheye camera, and we have those recommended on the wiki. But the other great things is we're working on support for ADS-B. So we're actually implementing support for tracking planes.
Okay.
We want to know about all the air traffic. And this is really important in the sense that if we see things on the camera, we can use ADS-B and FlightAware to actually determine if it's a plane up there. So it's a quick way for us to gauge what's actually in the sky in the video frame. And using other sensors like the weather sensors and light sensors, it gives us a really good feel for the local environment as well. So potentially something's affecting magnetic fields, or something is broadcasting RF on different frequencies, or there's an object in the sky that's not broadcasting an ADS-B signal, and we could potentially use passive radar, which is being worked on by Bob McGuire, that can detect objects that aren't broadcasting signals. So there's a lot of interesting capabilities in the platform that the more engineers and developers that we get involved, the faster and quicker we can expand these feature sets for the SkyHub tracker.
Have you got one of these out at Skinwalker Ranch?
So we do not have one out there yet. And I'm glad you brought up Jeremy earlier. So Jeremy McGowan, and yeah. I love what he's doing. And I really hope that the GoFundMe that Jeremy's using to build this tracker is a trend that really gets popular, because maybe somebody doesn't want to, he's planning on spending $3,000. So he's going to put together a very nice platform.
Yeah.
And $3,000 is a lot of money to spend on a platform. So I really hope like either people do co-ops or GoFundMe and groups of people in an area will get together and raise money to build this platform and do things like Jeremy's doing, bringing it out to Skinwalker Ranch. We do not currently have SkyHubs out there, but Jeremy plans on getting that SkyHub rolling and getting out to Skinwalker Ranch and seeing what he can collect out there. And I think it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, and that's it. It's not Jeremy's, he's not building this for himself. Yeah, he's putting it together and he's got the expertise, but if you donate to this and if you contribute, a part of it is yours. I'm not saying you can then claim that piece back at some point in the future, but you can kind of be a little bit proud and have the knowledge you've invested in it. You know, the data it's collecting, you've had a part to play in that. So if you're at all interested in the field and you can spare $1, $5, $10, whatever it may be, then that might be something. I think the listeners to this podcast, if you can't go out and build your own, then really please consider donating to Jeremy's, because really nice guy. He's just actually got into the UAP UFO field. I'd done Jeremy's first interview that was after Unidentified, and the how integrated he's become within the community is amazing, from me speaking to him before that show when he was really unsure. And he'll say himself that he wasn't sure how much he wanted to get involved. And he very quickly realized, no, this is something he wants to be a part of. So he's a big part of the community now. And I would love to see people getting involved in donating.
And there's one very important thing here. So, and I haven't quite talked about this yet, but the whole idea behind the SkyHub tracker is as it collects sensor data and video data, it uploads that to the cloud for the public to see. So everything that Jeremy's doing, all that data collected by that SkyHub tracker is going to be aggregated and made publicly available. So, you know, jump in and contribute. That data is going right to the public. That's for everybody to see and everybody to analyze.
And that was going to be my next question anyway, which is great. And it rounds off that journey to someone building this, setting it up. You know, they're filming a part of the sky. They're looking for anomalies, depending on the sophisticated equipment and what it's picking up. You can eliminate a lot of different things. And then you've got that steady stream of data being sent over to you, on a server or what, but basically collated by your guys on the cloud.
Yes. So, and I'll talk about that a little bit. So we do have Patreon supporters that help cover the cost of a cloud infrastructure that we host on Google. So Corey has, one of the guys on our team has set up the cloud infrastructure that everything runs. And we have Google Cloud Storage that all of the data gets dumped into. So currently that infrastructure exists to support all the trackers. All the trackers connect to this infrastructure. Our Patreon supporters support that infrastructure.
Have you got, like, what's the address for the Patreon? Do you know it?
Yes. It's actually Patreon SkyHub, patreon.com/SkyHub.
Again, I'll put the links in the description for the for folks who want to click on and contribute as well.
Yeah, if you go to skyhub.org and in the upper right, it says support SkyHub. You can actually make a recurring donation through Patreon, or you can make a one-time donation through PayPal, whichever is easier.
Again, this isn't free to do. So these guys like Steve and Adam, Bob, everyone he's named, Chris, are contributing their own time. And there's a cost to all this stuff, as I've talked about with the podcast and, you know, what Jeremy's building. But if you can contribute, then it's all very worthy causes as well. So definitely consider doing that. I want to ask, if you had a money is no object, what sort of price would you be looking at to build, you know, Steve McDaniel's perfect SkyHub setup? What would you think you could go to for pretty much perfection for what you're looking to achieve?
Man, I've actually never really thought about that. I spend most of my cycles thinking about what I need to do next to get more trackers out there and get more people involved. But honestly, I bet I could spend about $300,000 on a tracker. I know it's expensive, but some of the optics I've looked at are easily north of $100,000 just for one camera. I think
that's totally fair, though, because like you talked about the New York Times videos earlier, and I imagine the cameras on those fighter jets are in excess of hundreds of thousands of dollars, and at the end of the day, you still get a relatively grainy, a bit of blur video. Whether that's the full capabilities of these cameras are probably up for debate, and no doubt there's better quality out there, but I could see why you could push $300,000 for a camera.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to sensors and cameras and capabilities, I mean, you can really like FLIR cameras are very expensive for high-end cameras, so I would definitely go for optical cameras. I'd go for FLIR. I would put lots of sensors in it. I would probably put very high-end antennas and passive radars in it. So you can definitely spend a lot very quick. You can spend a few thousand dollars in just computing hardware. So I'd probably spend a lot if money was no object.
And I'm sure it's something you can get pretty obsessed over as well. Like when you start to build, like I say, with the PC, me starting to add a little bit to that, you can start to really enjoy it and add in, oh, look at the graphics have improved, or, oh, I've got a better camera, oh, I've got a better optic, you know, a better sensor. And you just start to get better and better, and there's always something more you can do.
And that's kind of the idea behind this platform, right? So let's say you just want to get started and you want to start with just a camera and just a GPS device and just a computer, right? Just the computing platform. And that's it. Like, let's say that's all you want to start with. If, you know, a few months down the road, you want to add in a couple more sensors, just add them in, plug them in, plug and play, it'll start working. And a few months later, let's say you want to add ADS-B and tracking planes, you can add that capability in. So this is very much, you can get started small and grow into a more sophisticated tracker over time. Because, you know, not everything's super cheap. The big ticket items are going to be the computing platform and the camera. But once you get past those things, things are relatively inexpensive. So you can pick up a sensor for like $15 for some of the sensors, or some of them are even like $7. So over time, you can expand and grow your SkyHub tracker.
And I know you said, obviously, you're looking for a certain quality, and the baseline, you're looking at $600 or $700. Is there no way that people could look to do a more of a budget option? I know you said you can't do it for $100, but $200 or $300, or would that just not be worth it?
So I think potentially, right? So there's a lot of very smart people out there that are engineers that would probably be able to go get some of the more like rugged camera sensors that don't have enclosures and aren't packaged in an IP67 housing. You could get very cheap if you go down that road. So if they're engineers and DIYers, they can go put that together for a few $100. So it really depends. I mean, there's some good cameras available that are camera modules that, you know, are less than $100 that you could put together with the $100 Jetson Nano. So you could probably get around with $250 to $300, really, really budget. But kind of after going through this and spending almost a year on it, people have convinced me that some things are bad ideas and others are good ideas. So I was actually taking the hardware aspect of this a slightly different direction. And Richard convinced me out of those things because he professionally designs enclosures and he made a lot of really good arguments. And there's a certain value to going down a certain path just out of, the quality of your build, how long it's going to last, and the value that you're going to get out of the data in the platform. And that kind of goes back to the enclosure that he designed, because he actually designed that for a very specific reason, to properly protect all the hardware and to make sure that we have a consistent build between trackers, which is very important as we push features out. Because if we want to do some of the more complex features, like tracking objects in the sky with two cameras, you actually want them to be fixed in a fixed position relative to each other. And that's easier to do if you have an enclosure and the sensors are in particular positions. It's harder to do if someone builds it in their own configuration. So there's factors there. So you could really go budget and eventually like work yourself up to like getting an enclosure and more expensive. But you know, I recommend anybody try it. Even if you go throw a few hundred bucks at this as a fun project, I'd say still get involved, but there are benefits to going down, getting a SkyHub enclosure and going that route.
And like you said, you get what you pay for. So there's right. a reason you're suggesting that $600 to $700, which again, when you take into consideration, you can buy a PlayStation 5 for that, then it's a fair price for what you're getting.
Yep.
That leads us on nicely then to listener questions. The first one would have been from Craig, but his was around when will enclosures be available. So Craig, that's been answered. Steve was saying hopefully January, but just keep an eye. You can pre-order though on skyhub.org. Is that right?
So we're not taking pre-orders yet, but we are asking that people express their interest. So jump into the chat or drop us an email at team@skyhub.org and let us know if you're interested, and we can start estimating the size of our first initial order. So if you're interested in that case, come let us know and we'll start working those numbers for everybody.
Yeah, there you go, Craig. Get in touch with Steve and the team and they'll sort you out. Craig was a long-time Patreon as well. Shauna, another long-time Patreon, she said, Steve, I don't know too much about SkyHub, but reading online, one of the SkyHub almost mission statements is you talk about using observable science and the use of a tracker. What do you mean by observable science, if you don't mind explaining that?
So I'll explain a little more than that, right? So kind of my approach to this is I'm very skeptical. I'm skeptical of most of the claims. It's not that I don't believe them. I don't necessarily like that word. I'm not convinced of them, right? And we all want evidence. So at times through this process, even when early on when I got involved in UFOs, I was told that UFOs couldn't be studied by science. But kind of my perspective was, if people are experiencing something or they're seeing something, whatever that thing is manifesting itself in reality, whether it's light or a physical object, and it's making a fingerprint on reality. So I argue that anything that we've seen or experienced can be studied by science. Now, the great thing about observational science, it's about studying things that are not easily repeatable. So you observe and you collect data. And with this data, you can generate trends and find patterns and generate models based off these observations. That's really our core goal. We just want to observe and we want to collect data. We want to be a completely passive platform. We don't want to introduce any signals into the local environment. We just simply want to observe and observe the UFO phenomenon to find these patterns and generate models to help understand what we're observing. And it's possible that a lot of the things that we're observing might be natural or have perfectly prosaic explanations, which is also a huge win because we're narrowing the unknowns.
I like that. Shauna had also asked about using a tracker and the projected costs, which we've talked about through the episode. So thanks for that, Shauna. Next up, Aliu, and I'm probably butchering the French name there. You've just almost touched on it, though, there, Steve, on environmental impacts. So what sort of considerations do people have to have, if any, for the environment?
in regards to deploying a tracker?
Just regards to, I think you touched on it though, where you're not introducing things like signals. So you're not going to be interfering with, I'm guessing, local wildlife, that sort of stuff. It's purely observational.
Yes. So one of the ideas behind this is, early on, people like threw in ideas like, oh, you know, you should mount lasers on it. So when something flies over, you should shoot like a laser at it. I'm like, well, I don't want to get arrested or deploy a platform shooting lasers at, you know, commercial jets. But really it comes down to, like I said, we just want to observe and we don't want to impact the local environment. We want to keep that to a minimal. So we don't even recommend wireless internet. You can use Wi-Fi, but we really want to minimize anything that's introduced into the local environment so we can just monitor what's happening and not impact. Well, we're going to impact that because we're taking measurements. However, we don't want to introduce anything unnecessary.
Yep, that's fair. What about the technical skills required to operate? And you've touched on that you want it to be as accessible as possible, but I'm guessing you have to have a base technical ability to put this stuff together from scratch.
Yes. So it is a DIY effort. Right now, this may not be accessible for anyone. But if you're brazen and daring, I highly recommend it. We're here to help you. You know, you gotta be able to turn a screwdriver, but you know, the team is here to assist with your build and work through any issues. We've helped about a dozen people already, just through the chat room, assembling their trackers and getting them deployed. And you know, there's people of all different sorts. Some people are technical and some people aren't, and we're willing to help anybody get their tracker going. And there's a great community of volunteers that are available to help.
To give a base level then for anyone who still struggles with the technical aspect of what you're discussing. So someone like me, who I would consider myself reasonably technical to a point, I would feel my height of technical ability has been recently where I unscrewed the panel from a PC, installed a new graphics card and some RAM, and then put it back together. Is that, as when you say brazen, would someone like me be capable of giving this a go, or would you still be looking for more?
Yeah, I think that should pretty much do it, right? So especially if you go to our wiki, we're constantly improving our documentation for assembling a tracker. So as long as you can follow a recipe or an instruction book. So if you've ever built a table from IKEA or followed a recipe to make a meal, you should be able to follow these steps to build something. So one note on that, and I'll talk about the enclosure a little bit. The enclosure is intended to simplify a lot of the build. So to have very precise instructions and screw holes for every particular part, and you know, to really simplify that aspect. But as long as you can swap out a graphics card or install some RAM, you should be good to go. You're just going to be plugging in a few wires and, you know, screwing some boards into an enclosure.
Cool. So taking it to the extreme where we talked about environmental impacts, Andrew Hall, who I recommend people check out, Dead Hand Radio, he's the host of that show. He thought it would be cool to have some sort of X-ray capability on the units. Now, that is certainly introducing some sort of environmental impact, but is yes. That something where you could see where that would go or how that could be useful?
So I'm maybe not the best person to ask that because I'm not super familiar with X-rays. I believe that's can be somewhat dangerous, right? Broadcasting X-rays.
You're starting to deal with radiation. Yeah.
Yes. I would see that unlikely. Mostly we want to do passive, right? So I could see cameras that are tuned for different ranges. But as far as X-ray, I think that's a little difficult because we don't really want to broadcast. So one thing I'd love to see in the platform is a Geiger counter. One of my pet projects, if I ever get spare cycles away from working on just getting the platform rolling out to the public, I'll probably make a muon detector module so we can detect subatomic particles using the Sky Hub tracker. So that's something that I'd eventually like to do. You know, projects like I believe MIT did that project where you could make a little $100 do-it-yourself muon detector. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with muons. It's just a subatomic particle that You can detect when they crash into a scintillator inside the detector. So you can count how many times a muon has crashed into the scintillator inside of the detector. So I think it's little experiments like that that we can do that might shed light onto some unknown thing in science.
Something, and this was a question from me off the back of Andrew's question. So it sounds like from what you've discussed, SkyHub is pretty much future-proof because it's so customizable. There's not really going to be anything that can't be replaced when it goes out of date because everything can just be swapped out for something else in a new part. Is that right?
That's our goal, right? And I think we'll be very future-proof. So our core platform is based around NVIDIA Jetson. So NVIDIA makes a class of products that are basically embedded computers with machine learning capabilities on them. They're very popular in drones and like vehicles on RC cars and things like that. So NVIDIA will continue to release new models of that platform. So even the computing hardware will be able to be replaced when the hardware in your tracker is outdated in 5 or 10 years. And if you decide you want to update, you know, you can just go order a brand new board from NVIDIA, swap it out in the platform, and continue to upgrade other aspects of your system.
And I would vouch for NVIDIA, looking at my NVIDIA graphics card that I just installed in the PC recently as well. So yeah, it's some good, and it looks pretty cool as well. So next question, again, we've got a radiation theme here from Richard G. Hopp on Twitter. What about using radioactive isotopes exposed to the sky to attract UAPs?
So it's, I'm not a radioactive isotope expert, but I would think this is probably a bad idea. I mean, so, we've always heard the claim that UFOs appear over nuclear facilities.
Yes.
I think it would be fascinating to test if there's actually a legal and safe way to do that. It seems like it would be an interesting test. But I'm definitely not an expert there.
I was going to say that I think the issue there, and I don't know if Richard wants to get in touch on Twitter and even yourself as well, it'd be good to hear a little bit more on that, because I was thinking straight away it ties in with the idea that these craft are attracted to nuclear material. Again, the Nimitz, the Tic Tac incident itself, that was a nuclear-powered carrier group. So the idea being that part of the reason they were observing the group were the nuclear capabilities or the nuclear kind of signals that were given off, short of tying a nuclear rod like seen in the Simpsons opening that goes in Bart's pocket to a pigeon and setting that off into the sky. And I think there's all sorts of reasons you shouldn't do that, folks, so please don't. That would be an interesting one to go about. But again, if that's just talking about how you could attract a potential UAP that you could then film, you know, maybe going with a CE5 or something a little bit safer might be the way forward. Interesting theory though, maybe one for down the line. Nick Madrid, he's talking about Chris Mellon recently appeared on Stars and Stripes, which is a military podcast. I don't know if you've heard the interview. I listened to it myself a few days ago, actually. And again, he hinted strongly at UAPs being a potential national security threat, and they are sizing up the capabilities of the military. And I know that's not necessarily something that SkyHub's deployed to do, but what are your thoughts on UAPs and potentially, you know, interfering with the military for those sorts of reasons?
So just to give a little context here, so we don't know what UAPs are. I think that we have more than enough evidence to conclude that they're real. Real physical objects. Somebody's flying something around the skies, and we don't know who it is, and we don't know what it is. And based on that definition alone, I think that's a huge threat, right? So my background, I worked for the Department of Defense for years. I was in the U.S. Navy and did naval intelligence. And when you look at issues like that, when you have, you know, aircraft flying through our skies unimpeded, that's a risk. That's a threat. That's something that should actually be concerning to people, which is, I'm a little bit surprised that the topic's not taken more seriously, because that's actually pretty concerning. Somebody has something that can essentially fly anywhere, and we don't seem to be able to do anything about it. So I think we should have we should be very motivated to understand the who and the what.
I think the general consensus and argument classically has been, and that's really interesting that is your background. One of the arguments has been that, you know, people don't know what this is and it's just swept under the rug or it's covered up. But then some people would subscribe to the idea, the reason that it's not gone after or treated more seriously within the halls of government and whatnot is because they do know what it is and they don't go after it for that reason, which, again, we don't know at the minute because you don't know if it's... Chris Mellon, for me, again, he's a very serious guy. He seems to know what he's talking about. He's been, if I'm wrong, forgive me, folks, but the Undersecretary of Defence. So that's a pretty respected and high-ranking position. And he has came out and basically said these are not US, Russian or Chinese. So we're going to then use common sense and as much as you can in this topic and eliminate that they are then not another country's equipment or craft either. Right. And on this, recently, I can't remember if it was the Phenomenon documentary or if it was on this radio broadcast, he mentioned he would like to eliminate ETs being a possibility because it would make things a whole lot easier. But based on what they see and the data, you can't eliminate that. So he's leaning towards it being something that's not US, Russian, basically not made by us, which it may or may not be the case. He could totally be lying and pull all our pants down in the end, but I hope not, and I doubt that. But yeah, that seems to be the kind of the angle he's taken. So what's your thoughts on that then?
So my thoughts on the whole thing, I'm not actually convinced anybody knows what they are, right? So I don't think there's a best assessment. I don't think anybody actually knows. And people always talk about disclosure. That's a big word in the community. I really think it's already happened, right? So we may not know everything, but I don't think there's really much more to know. The things that I think exist that we've never seen that's sitting, you know, behind some secret government program, I think they have more data, but I don't think they know. So I don't think they understand what it is or what they know. They just likely have higher fidelity data and more of it that's in the public. But I really don't think anybody knows what we're dealing with or what it is.
Just to pick you up on, you used the phrase, pardon me, there's not much more to know. Is that in the sense that there is nothing more they can find out or just nothing more the way things are done at the minute that they're going to find out?
So in the sense that, so the government has always has halfway acknowledged that. So they've come out and said UAPs are real, right?
Yeah.
So they basically said they're real. So if the government if the government has more, and this is speculating, so we're in speculating territory.
Yeah.
So if the government does in fact have more data, I don't actually think they know what it is. I just think they have more evidence to prove that it's happening. But we already know it's happening. So as far as do I think the government, when they, you know, disclose everything, are they going to roll alien bodies out of Area 51 and say, yeah, you know, it's extraterrestrials? I actually don't think that there's enough evidence on either in the public or in the government space to make a conclusion. We just know that UFOs are real in that sense. So that's why I think it's important for people to take it serious and, you know, be skeptical about it. Like I look at Sky Hub and it's definitely not an ET project. This is not about aliens. This is about understanding something that's unknown. And that's what science is about, right? We use science to explain things we don't understand, and we develop models to help explain the world around us and explain the universe. So if we have something truly unknown going on, we shouldn't be so afraid to pursue it, very rigorously and across the globe.
Absolutely. And that's my excitement with it as well, that if these tic-tacs, if that's what it is, and let's just take face value that David Fravor saw what he saw, 40-foot, tic-tac-shaped object, and these things go from the 80,000 feet altitude to the seabed in 2 seconds, then if that's not alien or multidimensional or whatever, and it's ours, then that's still incredible. Then that and opens up a lot more questions from a physics standpoint of how does that work? When did you discover this? You know, how does it run? Who makes it? How do you make them? When did it just suddenly change that we're spending billions of dollars? Was it $40 billion the US has spent on the Russians sending astronauts to space using the Soyuz module? And you think, so there's $40 billion that, you know, could that have been spent elsewhere? So that all that kind of stuff, it opens up a lot of different questions. And for me, whatever it is, I'd like to think we find out eventually, maybe in the next week or two, but probably not, folks, if you're hanging your hat on that UAP news being something like that. On the topic of government, though, Nick Martin, who listeners might hear a little bit more of soon from the show's point of view, he might be getting involved in a new show I'm doing. Have you been in contact with any government or corporations to cross-reference activity or using the data you've got?
Say that one more time. I didn't catch that.
So have you been in contact with any government organizations or corporations to cross-reference the data you have or any activity you've picked up?
So currently we have not collaborated with the government at all. We have talked to some private companies that have common interests about potentially, taking advantage of some of the AI solutions they have available. But as far as cross-referencing, we really haven't done that. I know other members of the community have talked about potentially generating tools to cross-reference SkyHub data with MUFON data. And, you know, if there's other projects like MADAR out there that want to use SkyHub to cross-reference to other events in MADAR, if MADAR wants to share data that can be cross-referenced with SkyHub events, that would be fantastic. But currently, we've mostly been focused on just getting SkyHub working end-to-end and getting the data out to the public.
And it may be too early, but Nick also asks, have you seen any emerging patterns in the data yet? Or
so that's really early, and I'll kind of give you some insight to where we're at. We have about 20,000 videos from the trackers right now. So one of the things that we're always short on is people. So to think about how huge this project is and how difficult it is, most all of the technical work for the software development has been done by just me and one other person. So it takes us a little time to get through things. We've had some great volunteers come in and people help guide us on some of the machine learning aspects, because I'm not a machine learning expert by trade. But fortunately, we've got experts that have PhDs in machine learning that are helping kind of guide some of the decisions that we make. However, with just two people doing development work, it takes time. So we hope to do that, and we're working towards that. We don't have patterns yet, but it's something that we're actively working on. And if that's something listeners want to get involved in, you can reach out to the team or reach out to Chris Cogswell and, you know, join the development team or join the scientific advisory board and help drive that mission.
Awesome. Are there any videos that you have seen? I know you're saying there's 20,000 there, that you would find particularly interesting. Is there anything that you've went wow at so far?
So one of my favorite videos is the one on our website. So there's two videos on our website that were actually taken in Houston, Texas, that show an object in the sky that's making non-ballistic motion above the city of Houston. So those two videos are very interesting. I personally can't spend a lot of time analyzing videos, mostly because I spend all my free time writing code for the platform. But, and I kind of briefly touched on that previously, as we get our automated machine learning and classification and anomaly detection more mature, we should be able to quickly automatically identify the videos that would be of interest.
Awesome.
So, I urge listeners to, if you're interested, or you're an engineer, a software developer, interested at all, or you have friends that are interested, come join the project and help build this out.
Yeah, folks, listen, worldwide, we've been put into lockdowns and quarantines, and people have a little bit of more spare time on their hands. So if you're looking to do something that's going to help out a worthwhile cause and give you some new learns and whatnot as well, something to do, then definitely get in touch with the team. Last question is from Dan, and he said, thank you for your work. Assuming everything goes smoothly, what does SkyHub look like in 5 years? He also asked, will it be used alongside other applications, which I think we've touched on, and could it plug into what TTSA are building?
I think that's a potential, right? The one thing that we wanted to make sure with the data that we're collecting, the data that we release publicly does not allow for commercial use. So we want to do that to make sure that the data remain free and that academics and the public can get in and use that data. So currently, we don't allow commercial use for the data from SkyHub, and we'd like to keep it that way. But we definitely want people to use it and do research and analysis with it and do studies with it. I think that would be fantastic. And as far as kind of my five-year plan, SkyHub has grown a lot since we started this. And the amount of time that I spend working on SkyHub has grown significantly. It capitalizes a lot of my time. I actually hope at some point that we can be a UFO research organization that can actually have a staff of engineers and scientists. And I think, you know, optimistically, hopefully we can find a way either through grants or funds to build an organization where we can have experts and engineers and other individuals help drive this mission, right? So if in 5 years we have 1,000 trackers deployed across the globe or more, that's going to take a significant infrastructure with support and full-time people to actually drive that. So in 5 years, I hope we're somewhere at that point. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with MITRE. So MITRE is a great organization that does research, and they're a nonprofit, and they have full-time engineers and staff that does research across a wide range of industries. And potentially we could do something along those lines, but focus more on the UFO phenomenon.
Amazing. Before we wrap up, Steve, I always like to finish off with a quick fire round. So just a few words or names or companies that you can say as much or as little on as you like, and then we'll finish off, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, sure. You know, I just want to say a huge thanks to everybody who's contributed to SkyHub. We have hundreds of members that have been really great to the project. We've had, you know, James and Justin in there helping with the 3D modeling builds, helping with the documentation and the website and keeping our socials up. And yeah, basically just thank you to the whole community that supported us to this point. I will kind of end this on, hey, you should, you know, if you're interested and you're tired of the rumors and tired of the hype and tired of being let down, SkyHub is a great way to get involved, to get your own answers. I mean, this platform is for us. This data is for us. So perhaps this data set exists somewhere behind a closed door, but this is your opportunity to get that data out into the public and be a part of something bigger.
Absolutely. I would encourage the listeners to get involved. You can really be part of something, like you say, that pushes the movement forward and gets answers one way or another, hopefully. That would be really, really cool. So you've shared a little bit on this, but your thoughts on To the Stars Academy.
So I think To the Stars Academy has actually done a ton for the community. I know people have like differing opinions about TTSA, but I think one thing's irrefutable. They've brought so much public awareness to this topic. I mean, I wouldn't be here doing this unless Tom DeLong created TTSA with Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon. I mean, and I think that's true for a lot of people that are involved in the topic right now. There's a lot of new people in this field that are here purely because of TTSA and the New York Times article. So regardless of how people may feel about TTSA, I think they've done great things for the community. At times it can be confusing, right? This is a weird topic. I mean, just look at Twitter. Like UFO Twitter is very complicated. There's lots of beliefs and ideas and opinions, but I try to be optimistic about all the efforts going on. I think TTSA has pushed things in the right direction and brought a lot of awareness to it. And I think kind of a testament to that is we saw legislation go through the Senate Intelligence Committee for the UAP task force.
Yeah.
And that's huge. I mean, we actually got in writing that the government set up a UAP task force from the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, we don't know if that actually produced anything useful for the public, but it is an acknowledgement that the U.S. government is taking it serious. And I would like to think that TTSA and Chris Millen played a large role in making that happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, for all intents and purposes, the U.S. government's came out and basically said UAP, UFOs are real. They've not said what they are. But if you had said 3 years ago you were going to have an admission by the government and then the U.S. Navy coming out and saying, yep, these are some videos of UFOs. But in 2020, it seems all bets are off and these things can very much get caught up in a wave of COVID and everything else. So maybe people are ready for a little bit more. Who knows? Following on from that one, your thoughts on Luis Elizondo?
So I'm a big fan of Lou. I think he actually sacrificed a lot. I also worked in the DOD, right? He gave up his job and his livelihood to, like, you know, bring information to the public and bring awareness, really. And, you know, probably at a huge risk, you know, like he's got a stable job, probably making decent money working in the government. And then you give that up to help bring awareness to the UFO topic, which comes with lots of stigma and at times ridicule.
Yeah.
And honestly, a lot of people avoid it because they don't want the criticism and they don't want to hurt their careers by talking about UFOs and, you know, strange phenomenon. But we had a guy that was willing to come out and do that for the greater good and for the public. So I'm actually a huge fan of Lou. I think he's done really great things for the community. So, I mean, he walks a very fine line, right? And, you know, I know a lot of people pressure Lou, like, oh, just, you know, break your NDA, give up the secrets. But, you know, those NDAs are there for a reason. There's a very specific purpose. And, you know, like others that have held clearances, like you took an oath to keep it secret and, like, you know, got to maintain your integrity and keep those oaths. So I think he walks a very fine line. And I don't think most people fully understand of how much he's really done for people walking that very fine line.
I absolutely agree. And do you know what? Let's just, for talking sake, Lou comes out tomorrow and goes, do you know what? I'm going to break my NDA. Here's what I know. He's never going to please anyone anyway, because he's just going to get people, yeah, that's what they've told him to say. He doesn't know anything. Or if they don't like what he says, then they'll just disagree with it. And so I think he knows that there's no point. And he said himself on various interviews, it doesn't matter what I think. It's right. This is what we're trying to do. And again, you'll no doubt appreciate his tagline of, you know, look at the data. He's all for look at the data. Let's get scientists behind this. Let's look at the videos. Let's analyze. Let's use AI and let's find out for ourselves what this is. You can find out, you know, you can push this forward. And that's definitely happening. So, yep, huge Lou Elizondo fan, as all the listeners know. Yep. Have you got any thoughts on CE5, which is Stephen Greer's communications protocol?
So not really. I've heard a little bit about it. I'll be honest. I've read 2 UFO books in my whole life. I'm actually not big on reading UFO books. I don't know too much about CE5, little bits and pieces here. I've watched some of Greer's documentaries, but really not much more than that. So I probably don't have too much to say about that.
No, but again, that's why it's good having people like yourself involved in this topic. And to be fair, doing what you're doing is pretty incredible, that you just want to see the data. You want to see a scientific approach. And as Shauna asked about earlier, it's observable science. And if one of these sky hubs picks up a huge ET craft flying over New York one time and the data proves conclusively, no, this thing's incredible, great. But that's probably really unlikely. But what you might find as the cameras improves and technology improves is there's something to this topic. So it's we don't know yet. It's far too early to decide where it's going to go. But again, people like yourself being that interested, what do you think then about the notion CE5 being that you can summon extraterrestrial beings using essentially what is the power of, you know, the human spirit in your mind and everything? Is that something then being so scientific that you don't put a lot into?
So I think that you can pursue anything scientifically, right? So I'm of the opinion we all don't need to be scientists, but we can all use a scientific method. And there's always a way to establish fine guidelines for a hypothesis to test and maintain strong controls and test something. So yes, I'm a firm believer. If and some people might call it fringe or weird or metaphysical, by all means, pursue those things. But I employ people, be skeptical, use the scientific method, pursue it with rigor and a strict process. Because that's how you're going to create a model to understand what's actually happening. These things are happening, even being rigorous about recording data or taking notes or documenting these things is important. So even in your own journey, even if you don't get involved in SkyHub and you pursue the UFO phenomenon, be rigorous and use a solid, well-known methodology like the scientific method. It'll help you.
Awesome. Have you followed the Bob Lazar story? And if you have, what are your thoughts on Bob Lazar's claims?
So, yeah, I'm very familiar with the Bob Lazar story. That's a story that seems to pop up every so often. Honestly, I don't think, in my opinion, I'm not convinced. I don't think there's enough evidence. It's a difficult one, right? So there's a lot of people that really believe Bob, and there's a lot of people that think Bob's lying. I really haven't come to a conclusion on it, other than I don't currently think there's enough evidence to support his claims. It would be fantastic if it were true. It would change everything, right? But currently, I don't think the evidence is there to support the story yet. So if at some point he comes out with Element 115 and shocks us all, then maybe we can double back and, okay, let's look into this a little bit more, because even if he did provide Element 115, it doesn't prove any of his other claims other than he has Element 115. So we need to take that even further to verify his further claims. But a good first step is show us the 115.
Okay, cool. I like that. And again, he's a scientist, isn't he? So you would...
He seems very intelligent. I've seen the documentaries that he's been in. He seems like a bright guy. He's not dumb.
Yeah.
But smart people can mislead people. But it's difficult, right? Maybe he's telling the truth. Maybe he's not. One position I try to take is I'm not here to say what's true or false. I'm just here to collect data. And I try to approach things, whether with a low level of confidence or a high level of confidence, because I think it would be unfair of me to say that something that someone has experienced or seen is false, right? Because I don't want to tell them they didn't have an experience or this didn't happen to them. Yeah. I just simply take the position, I can't be convinced unless there's credible evidence to support it.
No, of course. And I say regularly on the show as well, and more as I've got more confident and done more episodes and, you know, the listener base grows, that I have my own thoughts and my own opinions on what may or may not be going on. Those are fluid. And even in the last 6 months I've done this podcast, depending on people I've spoken to and things I've seen, and, you know, again, different, you know, if you want to, scientists that have come out, different government officials that have come out, I will make my own mind up. But at the end of the day, everyone who comes out with an opinion at the minute could all be wrong, but only one person or one theory can ultimately end up being correct. So right now there's a lot more of us could end up with egg in our face than be right, which is, like, again, why what you're looking to do and what you're pushing, you know, scientific, you know, data, the hard facts, here's what we do know, is definitely a huge part of what's going to get us the answers at the end of the day. That does lead me on, though, to the next question that I could imagine if I just come out and ask you, you may give an answer that I'd have to push you on. So I'd like you to, as best you can, you talk about low confidence, high confidence, the actual phenomenon itself, what's going on. Now, you're not going to come out here and tell me you think it's aliens, but if you had to come down on one side of the fence as to what is happening, what are the craft on these videos, and what are people seeing worldwide, what do you think's going on?
So, and you're right, I don't think it's I don't think there's enough evidence to support ETs, but I'll give you the best answer that I can.
Yeah, please.
So if we go back in history and we look at when laser technology and fiber optics were invented, and when we realized that technology, there was lots of theoretical physics and theoretical math that supported those technologies that was theorized years and years before we ever realized that technology. So if you look back in from the 70s and before, academia and private sector and the government was doing research into those two technologies for lasers and fiber optics. We can go back in history and look at all the research that was iteratively done across the entire globe and country that was done within the private government, was done within the private sector, and that was done in academia. And we can follow that path that led up to laser and fiber optic technology. So if we look at that scenario, you couldn't hide those two pieces of technology. Like, you just couldn't hide them, right? There was just thousands and thousands of people involved in that research and making that technology work and function. So if we look at things like the Tic Tac and the data produced on those three videos, along with the witness testimony, and we really do have an aircraft out there that's exhibiting capabilities that's, you know, flying, what, 18,000 miles per hour in the atmosphere and making these kind of maneuvers. There's no body of evidence that currently exists in academia or the private sector or government projects that's available to the public that supports any of that technology. And I'm also not convinced that you could hide those kind of advancements for such a long time, because the Nimitz incident, I think we're going on 15, 16 years since it happened.
Yep, 16 years, just a few days ago, yep.
Yep, and if you look at history, things like this has happened before. I see a video that Stanton Friedman shared back, I believe in the 80s, that looked very similar to a Tic Tac, right? I don't know the provenance of that video, but if we actually really do have these sophisticated aircraft and there's no research to actually support that technology, I'm definitely leaning towards not ours. And when I say not ours, not from humans. Mm-hmm. So it does seem the evidence is mounting towards another explanation, but I don't know what that is, right? And I'm still not a fan of the ET hypothesis, but it does appear that it's not ours.
It's something else than human. Else.
And it's interesting because, and I kind of don't like saying this as a skeptic, but the universe is a big place and we don't understand things. And maybe it's something that we have never considered. And, you know, I've heard people talk about extraterrestrials. I've heard people talk about time travelers and interdimensional. And maybe it's just something we've never even like considered, or something that maybe we can't quite comprehend yet.
I think my opinion changed. I've never mentioned this particular thing, but as to why I start to lean a little less ET and more different realities bleeding through, or multidimensional, or another type of civilization being on the planet alongside us, aka a la a sort of Wakanda, if you're a Black Panther fan. But it was Lou Elizondo, one of his first interviews he done, or videos, was the whole humankinds, that it's not humankind or mankind, but mankinds. And there's a reason he's come out and said that. So for me, it's like, for someone who's not giving away too much in what he says and talks about the data, he has literally come out and said, what if it wasn't just mankind? What if it was mankinds?
I mean, that would be fascinating, right? And
incredibly, yeah.
So one of the reasons I don't actually like the ET hypothesis, and it might be short-sighted to have this perspective, but things are really far away from each other in space. And it takes a massive amount of energy. And space isn't really, like, biologically for humans, it's not great for humans to live in space. Like, once you get out into space, you have to deal with, you know, gamma rays and zero G
radiation, you know, belts and radiation. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to deal with all these issues, and we're just not made for that. And if if there is intelligent life out there and there may have a similar biological makeup, that probably wouldn't do great in space. Maybe they could overcome the technical hurdles of traveling through space. But the biggest one seems to be energy. It's just so much energy to get across space. And potentially somebody may have figured that out. But currently, based on our understanding, I think that's a very low probability that something's actually traveling that distance to Earth. So that's why I'm not a huge fan of the ET hypothesis yet, until we can exhibit that those breakthroughs are possible.
And to be totally fair to you, though, a lot of the things you've claimed here and said you're not a fan of or you don't necessarily believe in, you've tended to use the word yet at the end. So that's totally fair that you're leaving yourself open to say, and like I try to do as well, that I could be wrong. I just, at the minute, I don't think this. So until something presents itself otherwise, this is what I believe, which is totally fair. I want to know, do you prefer the term UFO or UAP?
So I actually prefer UAP, but sometimes when talking about it, it's so much easier just to say UFO, because it seems like everybody that's into the UFO community knows what a UFO and a UAP is. But if you ever talk to anybody about this outside of the community, most people haven't heard of the term UAP.
No.
So sometimes when you're trying to communicate the idea to people, it seems easier to use UFO when you're speaking to individuals outside of the UFO community.
Absolutely. And the last one, it's just to sum up, but you did touch on this already. Your final thoughts on disclosure as a process.
My final thoughts on disclosure as a process. I think people need to get out and be diligent and search for answers themselves, whether it's through SkyHub or through another effort in the community. Stop spinning cycles, speculating and debating on who's right and who's wrong, and go join a project where you can actually make an impact and a change. And, you know, if you consider SkyHub as one of those projects you can jump on to help with disclosure, maybe we can play a small part in finding answers. And maybe disclosure will never happen, or maybe it already happened, but really what we want is to understand, you know, unknown things.
I like that. And like you said before, you feel it's sort of happened already, but maybe from here on in, if people want more answers, they're going to have to pick up the baton themselves. And that's where SkyHub, listening to podcasts, watching documentaries, getting involved in other people's SkyHub builds, you know, getting behind TTSA, that all starts to come into play, and people have to get behind these things themselves.
Yep. And, you know, for your listeners, I'd say ask yourself a simple question. What if no one has the answer yet? And the answer you're waiting for, no one has. And so one way to find that answer is to go looking and work for it. Science isn't easy. Science is messy. And science is time consuming. So, you know, the longer we procrastinate, the longer it's going to take to get those answers.
I like that. Steve, it's been great speaking with you. If you can just let the listeners know again how they can get in touch with you, how they can get involved in SkyHub, just to wrap up, that would be great.
Okay. Thanks for having me on. If you guys want to check out our website, you can check us out at skyhub.org. And we also have a community chat at chat.skyhub.org. You can jump over to our Patreon, and that's patreon.com/skyhub. So yeah, you can shoot us an email and catch the whole team at team@skyhub.org. We're always around to help out.
Awesome. Been great speaking with you, Steve. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Cheers, man. That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access the shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, That UFO Podcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer. More like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing baseball. noise for the Parliament effect. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little bit. Meditated again and stayed full on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. Then I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. I called out to my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should seek therapy. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.